Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. My name is Chuck.
And I'm Jess.
And we'll be with you for the next hour, bringing you some discussions from people doing extraordinary things with a unique connection to our sweet little state, Kentucky, right here. So nonetheless, joining us on the line is a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi everybody, it's Bianca Spriggs.
Hey B.
Hey B.
Hi, very disheveled Bianca Spriggs. But it's good to talk to you guys today.
It's great to talk to you too. And I know you're super busy, you know, gearing up for a trip. So thank you for taking time out with us to chat.
Of course.
And so for folks that don't know, Bianca Spriggs is an Appalachian poet, Caveh Kanem fellow, visual artist and activist, has taught at Transylvania University, UK, and will soon be an assistant professor of English at the University or Ohio University. Is the founder of the Swallowtail Project, and had her poem tattooed on 253 people in the city of Lexington for the Lexington Tattoo Project. Also was a 2016 Sally Bingham Award winner, a Pushcart nominee, and also is the author of four collections of poems, most recently Call Her By Her Name and The Galaxy is a Dance Floor. Bianca is also the co-editor of three poetry anthologies, most recently Undead, Ghouls, Ghosts, and More, and the forthcoming Blackbone, 25 Years of the Appalachian Poets, coming out from the University of Kentucky Press, home team. Shout out.
Chewy.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And when do you find time to sleep, Bianca? That's the first question.
I actually don't sleep a lot, believe it or not. Sleep is for weenies, you know? I nap during the day. I take about an hour nap, and then I'm up till all hours of the night wandering around the house with the cats. So,
nap power.
Yeah, that's great. I'm a night owl too.
Me too. I have to do it. So, Bianca, my first question for you is, where were you born?
Okay, so this is going to ruin my Kentucky street cred, but I was actually, I'm a Yankee. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I've lived there off and on, you know, at various points in my life. So, yeah.
Nice. Do you get an opportunity to go back to Milwaukee often?
No, I haven't been back in about 12 years. I'm actually taking a little road trip up here in a few weeks to visit some people. So it'll be the first time I've been back to, like, my actual hometown in about 12 years. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So, Bianca, if you could tell our listeners about your college career.
Oh.
Where you went.
Yeah. Okay. So, I did my undergrad at Transylvania University. And then I went to UWM Milwaukee for a year and got my master's. And then I came back and actually started teaching college in Bowling Green, Kentucky for 3 years. And it's a bit patchwork from there. So, because I really wanted a folklore degree. And
cool.
So I got into the folklore program at Western, you know, Western Kentucky University, and did that for a while. But then I got married. So, you know, I had to do wedding stuff and then move back to Lexington. And it took me a while, but after about 5 years, I decided I wanted to go back to school and just finished up a PhD after 6 years at the University of Kentucky. So.
And Dr. Spriggs, your undergrad degree, it was history, right?
It was history, yeah. I have a degree in history. And, like, so a lot of my poems are historical, historically based, like, whether persona or other areas. And it kind of goes back to that first love and looking at people's stories.
Can I ask you, Bianca, what brought you to Kentucky from Milwaukee initially? Why did you decide to go to Transy or Western?
Well, I mean, I've been in Kentucky off and on since I was 11. So my dad moved us up here. He was working with IBM. Mm-hmm. And so in 91, we moved up here. And ironically, that was the year the Appalachian Poets were founded. I'm a second generation member, but I just feel like cosmically, you know, it's all linked somehow, you know. So, yeah, my dad moved us up here, and I was moved around a lot as a kid, but I ended up always coming back to this fine state.
It's a wonderful spot. And what do you think it is about Lexington, or I know since you studied history, Lexington's history, that you think makes this a unique place to create in?
Well, there are a lot of ghosts. there are a lot of ghosts around here. The energy, it's unlike anywhere that I've ever lived. And I don't know if it's because, you know, we are touched by seven different states, or we're just kind of like that Confederate buckle, you know, on the the state line there.
The gateway to the South.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know what it is, but Lexington's history just, I mean, like I said, and the ghosts, you know, it's like there are a lot of things that people don't talk about around here. Like, we just don't talk about it. And once you start finding out, then you're like, oh, that's why it feels like no one can really ever put roots down here. Or that's why people keep coming back, you know. So there's just a lot of things that I can't explain, energetically speaking. But in terms of being an artist, everyone here that I've met has always been really super supportive of one another. The literary community here is very supportive of one another, and that, if you go other places, it's not like that everywhere. So even major cities, you know, it's more like crabs in a barrel, but Lexington has a really, you know, we all know one another, and we all read together and go to each other's workshops and book release parties and, you know, opening events, and it's like we're very enthusiastic about our writers. So that's awesome to have.
Yeah, and as you know, working together at the Carnegie Center, we're constantly, you know, trying to cultivate our readers for our writers. And I was just wondering, who encouraged you to read growing up?
Well, I mean, my mom was an English major back in the day. And so she was always reading me stories and, you know, over and over and over again, like the same stories over and over and over again. But, I will never forget the day my dad walked in to the living room, came home from work, and he had this giant box sitting in front of him. I was maybe like 9 or 10. And he said, I know you like to read. You know, my dad's like, he'll read a computer manual. You know, like that's what he likes to read. So he's like, he had a nerdy daughter who liked stories. And he brought this giant box, and they had some partner at IBM, a printer, like a book printer, a publishing house or something. And they had just brought all these books over. And he brings me this giant box of books home, like thick books, like 500-page books. I'm like 10, right? He's like, here you go. Read some of these. And he's like, these will keep you busy. And I did. I started reading, like, science fiction and fantasy. My first love in fantasy was David Eddings. And I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't started reading those books. And then I became that kid on the school bus who was just, like, sitting in the back, you know, reading her books every day, her giant books. I haven't really stopped.
Well, I have to say, from, like, the outside, attending all the readings over the years that you've done and seeing your dad right there in the front row, I've always thought you all were just like the sweetest father-daughter duo ever.
Well, he does it to keep an eye on the competition. I don't know if any of you all who are listening have ever met Ron Spriggs, but it's really hard to keep up with that 76-year-old man, let me tell you.
Yeah, he's got a new box of books in his trunk just ready to drop on you.
Just ready. Well, I mean, if you go down I-75, you know, my dad has a Tuskegee Airmen Memorial exhibit that he's been working on for, like, you know, almost 2 decades now. So you go up and down I-75 and you see those Tuskegee Airmen Memorial Trail signs. My dad got those put there, you know, so like he's a hustler. He really is.
That's
it's hard
awesome.
To keep up with him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. So Bianca, I know, you know, especially with reading is a huge part of being a writer, but when did you find poetry or where did you find poetry?
I think the first poet I was exposed to was Shel Silverstein.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so, like, if you see Galaxy, if you read Galaxy, there are drawings in Galaxy, and I was like, oh, I want to be the Shel Silverstein for adults. But now that I go back and read Shel Silverstein, I'm like, oh, he was writing for adults, you know?
Yeah.
So he's, like, the first Pixar. he was probably the first, like, poet that made poetry pleasurable for me. And I think I just got into it through, you know, I read a lot of Maya Angelou's biographies, autobiographies, or her memoirs growing up, and I really enjoyed her poems, and I got a chance to see her when I was a freshman at Transy, around 18. A friend of mine had a ticket to see her at the Singletary Center. So imagine, you know, 18 years ago, sitting at the Singletary Center with Nikki Finney opening for Maya Angelou, and you're like four rows away, and it was a life-altering event. And of course, anytime someone sees Nikki Finney read, you know, for the first time, I mean, she definitely leaves an impression. So,
well, Bianca, I think a lot of people probably feel that way about you as well.
Oh,
I agree, Chuck.
You know, I have some big shoes to fill, you know, and wouldn't have been able to do something like that if it hadn't been for Nikki or the Appalachian poets, you know, demonstrating or modeling that, yes, there are contemporary Black writers who are not dead, and they are, right. You know, at the podium, and they're reading about things that sounded familiar to me, but I'd only heard in, like, you know, a church context or, comic stand-up routine, but, you know, they were writing poems. So Maya Angelou, she, like, charged everybody in the audience that evening to, like, we needed to read poetry, we needed to write poetry. I thought she was just talking to me, you know, in a crowd of, like, you know, however many people. And so I did. I took her very literally. And I haven't stopped because no one's told me to stop yet. So.
Well, please don't.
Yeah. I'm wondering that the support you talk about, which I think is right on. We always say that at the Carnegie Center that the literary community, writers thrive here because of the community and the support that people get from their fellow writers. And I'm just wondering, as a multidisciplinary artist, where your different mediums intersect, have you found that same support in other fields outside of writing?
Yeah. Well, I think that I surprised everybody with the visual art yeah. several years ago. I mean, because I know how to compartmentalize my life very well. But I was a studio art minor. Like I've been drawing for my entire life before I can write. You know.
Right.
So I did a lot more of that in high school. When poetry showed up, it just, you know, really didn't leave me the same. But when I started working on the dissertation and those kinds of comp exam projects around 2012, you know, the writing wasn't coming. So I started doing these little doodles and drawings. I was invited to do a show by Ed at Special Media.
Shout out to
White and Red.
Ed
yeah.
Franklin. Big ups.
Ed Franklin. And it really changed the course of my visual art career because I started doing these little funny drawings, and it just reminded me that, you know, that was part of my wheelhouse too, and got a studio at the Bread Box, and, you know, the rest is history. So, you'll find that a lot of writers actually are kind of bilingual or multilingual in terms of genre or medium. You know, a lot of us are visual artists. We're also photographers, or, you know, we like to paint or draw or, like, make sculpture. So it really is, you know, in that sort of same creative vein, I think, just to be a maker.
Yeah, and do you feel like, and, you know, I think this is definitely something that's uniquely Lexington, too, because, you know, as we talk about sometimes on the show, sometimes, you know, the same person that'll go play a sellout concert in Sweden will come back and be washing dishes at a restaurant in Lexington. So I think to survive in Lexington, but also to thrive here, and I think, you know, reap all the benefits of our city, you have to be multidisciplinary and kind of renaissance. Mm-hmm. So there's so many people doing different things. And I know we've talked about, you know, starting out with visual art, but moving here and no one even knowing that that's your emphasis. So I think it's really interesting. And, you know, I think, and Bianca, you know, I've been, hearing you read for a long time, and I know we read together at Holler 5. So I wanted to ask you kind of specifically about the poetry scene here. You know, what do you think of kind of what Holler Poet Series did and kind of the Lexington performance poetry scene as it is right now in its current state?
Well, I just saw something online about a Dada poetry slam of some sort happening at Owls. I don't know if you guys saw that. I just saw it on Facebook.
I did. I got an email about it, but...
Yeah, so I don't know who's putting that on. I don't know anything about it, but that's kind of exciting. So, but yeah, Eric Sutherland, I mean, he gave me my first ever feature, you know, at the Bluegrass Baking Company all those years ago, and he has a growing hand. I mean, he's a trained arborist anyway, but he knows how to grow poetry communities, and just by offering a space and a microphone. And so when people say, what can I do to help? You know, artists, we need a space. And we need a microphone. And Eric was very intuitive in that sense. He also had endurance and longevity. And it takes a lot to host even, like, an annual event, like the Wild Women of Poetry Slam. You know, that takes a lot of time. So he did that. He pulled that off, in essence, every single month for 8 years, you know.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who started off in that scene as neophytes, you know, initiates, who now have book deals, who've gone on to, like, you know, really have their writing or literary or artistic career flourish. And it's because there was this wonderful gumbo of voices and talent and ability all informing one another, and, you know, you really just can't get better than that. So I don't know what the future is for that. I find that in Lexington, the poetry scene is sort of like a pendulum, mm-hmm. you know? Sometimes there's, you know, an event on every corner.
yeah.
Sometimes there's nothing for, like, years. So I don't know. I think it remains to be seen. It'll be exciting, whatever it is.
I think so, too. And, you know, you can cut the head off of it, but the roots are still there.
That's right.
And they're deep.
yep.
you know, well, speaking of, you know, people making a professional career out of writing and poetry, you know, how did you get started as a professional writer? Like, at what point were you like, all right, this is what I'm going to do?
Okay, so I had already had two collections out at this point. And this is back in 2010, and I'd had two very different but the same conversation, just with different people, with two of my mentors. One was Nikki and one was Patricia Smith. And both of them had asked in their own way, what are you trying to do? You know, like, you played at this, you know. And I was working a desk job for arts administrative desk job and just trying to figure my life out. And, I would just blurt out, I want to write. Well, they were like, you need to figure out how to make that happen. And I said, you know what, I need to learn how to become a better scholar, a better researcher. My background in academia and in literature, literary fields has been very spotty. And I need something consistent. So I got a KFW grant to work on what is now called Call Her By Her Name in 2010. And then I quit my job and started to patch it together and study for the GRE. And by 2011 fall, I was in an English program learning how to become a literary critic. So, I think that's pretty much the shortest answer I can give.
What would you say your work focuses on?
I would say most of my work is interested in hybridity and, in terms of visual imagery, like people in states of, or animals, or mythological creatures, or androids, whatever, in states of transition or transformation, because you can't have creation without destruction. So I'm really interested in that kind of, like, gray space where someone is about to turn into something else, or someone else. That's when people get really interesting to me, is when they're kind of faced with a choice or decision. I also tend to write about women's issues, particularly women of color, specifically Black women, and how patterns of xenophobia are exercised and played out on our bodies and our ability to access certain conversations. And so I'm trying to write us back into the center from the margin, essentially. so both my scholarly work and my creative work have a lot to do with the voices and the bodies of Black women.
The fascination with transition, the way you worded it, was really intriguing to me. Mm. And I was thinking about your Swallowtail project. Was that, you think, your motivation behind that? Your interest in... And if you could tell the viewers about it too,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
listeners. Your project. Yeah, it started. It started off as going into women's detention centers, those kind of facilities, and doing workshops, creative writing workshops. And originally, we partnered with KDBA, and.
And what is KDBA?
KDBA is the Kentucky Domestic Violence Association. I think they're under a slightly different name now, but I can't recall what it is. But LaTanya Jones and I kind of dreamt up this program because I had another conversation with Sonia Sanchez at the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and took what she said very personally and very literally. And she was like, did you all know at dinner time? She was like, did you know that there is a group of neglected writers on the edges of your town? What are you all doing to get to them? And I was like, what? What are you talking about?
You're at Common Grounds?
What's yeah. Like,
they forget it was open mic night on Monday and not
yeah,
Wednesday?
I was like, what reading have I not heard about? You know? And so she started talking about, and this was back in like 2004. Mm-hmm. So she started talking about, you know, these women who've been incarcerated and, you know, they needed somebody to help them take ownership of their own narratives. So I went away and for like, you know, 4 or 5 years and came back, and I reconnected with LaTanya at the job that I was working at that I eventually ended up leaving, and she knew I was interested in having a program like that. And she was like, you know, we got some funding. Do you want to make this happen? And I was like, absolutely. And so I roped in photographer Angel Clark. We had Santana Berry as our first intern. And LaTanya went in as an advocate. And our first reading was Frank X. Walker. And who else was down there? Lisa Kendrick, maybe? Maybe. I have to go back and look. And we did a reading at the Women's Medical Center on Leestown Road and gave everybody books and started a workshop. So that was the beginning of that.
Well, did you find that, you know, that artistic expression and was therapeutic to the incarcerated women there?
It was therapeutic, but, you know, there was only so much that they could really feel comfortable saying because we didn't know the dynamics inside. And, you know, shows like Orange is the New Black kind of glorify or romanticize prison culture. So, you know, I never really knew what they were up against, you know, inside. And when we went to the Fayette County Detention Center, the turnover rate was much higher. So there were people who could have been in there for like 2 days, 2 weeks to a year, you know, and so we were kind of like starting over every single week when we started going there. And some people were just bored and they would just go to anything, you know, that wasn't what they were constantly looking at. And I'll tell you, I mean, the sensation of sitting in a cell and, you know, teaching a workshop and having those hydraulic doors close behind you. I mean, just even as, you know, the workshop instructor, you kind of get this sort of panicky feeling like, oh, my God, I hope those doors open back up, you know. And we got to leave every week, you know, and they had to stay. So that was really a life-altering experience. I don't really know the future of the Swallowtail Project at the moment. I'd really like to work with formerly incarcerated women because I think that they'll be able to speak more freely and have more access to materials than they did when they were locked up because, you know, if you could, if somebody took a pen, everybody's getting patted down or shook down, you know, to get that pen back. So it's just made for, like, a really stifling kind of environment, but it was therapeutic for a lot of people. There were a lot of tears, a lot of snapped fingers, you know, a lot of encouragement and a lot of support. So among the women in general.
Well, that's awesome.
I'm really glad you pursued that project and saw it to the completion. It's really great.
Yeah, it's really revolutionary work, you know.
Well, I think, you know, what we realized is that we were only a few people, you know, and that's why we put the book together, the Swallowtail Project book, so we could donate copies of the writing exercises and samples from the women's writing. And we donate copies wherever we go because we just realized, you know, we're just a couple people. We can't do this full time, unfortunately. If I could, I would, you know. It was that meaningful of work to me. But that's why we ended up doing the book of writing exercises to make sure that people had access to those narratives, even if we weren't there.
That's great.
Yeah.
And even with, you know, for people who might be out there listening right now, is there anything that we can do or that they can do to help support them?
Book donations, consider your book donations. And I'm not talking about like the paperback, you know, Western romances, you know, I mean,
right.
You know, if you have literary journals, old magazines, you know, that are kind of quality, and especially if they're like how to write, how to get your characters out, that sort of thing, you know, they could really stand to use some donations in all the facilities. So their librarians would be ecstatic, their English teachers, because a lot of them are studying for the GRE, the GED, and some of them are studying for the GRE. I met women with master's degrees, you know, so, yeah. So it's not that these women are, I mean, it's just interesting to kind of realize that just a choice or two is the difference between who's sitting across, you know, who's in a jumpsuit and who's not, you know, sitting across the table from one another. But yeah, book donations are a big deal. Paper donations, pen donations, you know, contact the librarians, take some initiative and contact librarians or resources like KDVA and see what you can do to, you know, donate there. You know, books of poems, books of just, again, quality literature. that's sorely needed.
That's great information. And just in case people are out there and they're just joining us, we're talking with Bianca Spriggs, Lexington poet, Kentucky visual artist extraordinaire, among many other things, filmmaker. So nonetheless, Bianca, we're going to take a quick little break, but we'll be right back if you don't mind hanging on the line with us.
Okay, no problem.
Great. Well, nonetheless, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here with Chuck.
And Jess Moeller.
And Jess. And, sorry, Chuck. No worries. And we'll be right back here in a little bit. Thanks for listening. Hey, everybody, and we're back here listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky, here up on 6th Street in the beautiful Bluegrass State. I'm Chuck.
I'm Jess.
And we're on the phone with Bianca Spriggs. Hi, Bianca.
Hello. Hey, I'm here.
Excellent. Well, thanks for joining us.
When we were talking about this, when we were talking about the Swallowtail Project, you mentioned a collaboration with Angel Clark, and I know you all have become extremely good friends and collaborated on several other projects, and I'm just curious how you all met, and if you could maybe catch us up to speed on other projects you all have worked on together.
Yeah, I met Angel actually right, like, it was maybe my junior year in college at Common Ground, and which I met a lot of people who were very significant to my life there, because I basically had a cot in the back. So
I remember those days.
Yeah, that's right. So I met Angel. She was at the coffee shop with her then boyfriend, and they'd just moved to town. And I don't know, we just kind of struck up a conversation, and then she ended up working there. And, you know, we just became besties pretty fast. And so now it's to the point where I can never cross her, you know, because she's got too much information. So we started collaborating with Pluck at the University of Kentucky. We started collaborating with our first, as artists, we started collaborating with that first film, Waterbody. Back in 2011. That came about because of a conversation that we'd had on the road from Louisville to back to Lexington, and she loved that poem, and she's like, what if that poem was like, what if we did a movie like that one day? And then by the time we got back to Lexington, it was like, what if we do a movie like that, like, next week?
And then the next week was like, where do we film the mermaids?
Yeah, well, we filmed them, you know, in that dirty little creek behind Walmart.
I love that.
Or J.D. Lester's pool.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And that, I mean, actually, you know, that's how, you know, Kate Hatfield and I became really close friends, and Landon Antonetti, and they ended up getting married last year. So
shout out.
So there were a lot of collaborations and important, you know, sort of connections that sort of did a real spinoff over the next several years, and I don't know if that would have happened had we, you know, Angel and I not had that conversation. So, we brought her on again for the Swallowtail Project, and then she became our photography editor for Pluck and did most of the covers over the last several years. Mm-hmm. And then we did the 13, of course, which was a very important collaborative project with other Kentucky artists, including Angel, revolving around 13 black women and girls who were lynched in the late 19th to early 20th century. So,
well, can you tell us, can you talk a little bit more kind of about how that project came about? Because it involved quite a few people.
It did. And that was one of those things where where I look back now, I'm like, how did we pull that off? There were so many musicians. anybody who's ever worked with one musician knows that, you know, it can be a challenge. So they just have their own sense of time, you know, space.
I'm married to one.
Yeah, exactly. And a drummer who loves, you know.
You got to keep that tempo.
Actually, this was, you know, the 13 is really, a lot of that had to do with Angel, because I went to Andrea Fisher, curator at Transylvania University in the Moreland Gallery, and I'd found out, I'd done my research on a woman named Laura Nelson, who was lynched in Oklahoma from a bridge, and with her son. And so I'd been doing research on her, and it occurred to me, I was like, I'll bet there were some women lynched in Kentucky, given the nature, the tumultuous nature of the state. And I found a list of names and wanted to pay homage to them and just kind of celebrate the fact that they are part of our shared state and national history, and that they walk this land and breathe this air, and that they're part of us, mm-hmm. and just mourn their deaths and celebrate their lives and that kind of thing. So, we were visiting Andrea to talk about. I was like, I just like to do like a small ceremony or something in a corner of the gallery between shows, and just to call out their names and, just pay homage. And of course, Angel was with me. We hadn't talked about this beforehand. We kind of talked about it, and I just, I had this, vision of a little altar and just everybody lighting candles, and it was going to be very quaint. And Angel takes a lap around Moreland Gallery, and she says, "I want the whole gallery."
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, that's why we collaborate.
is why we collaborate. And so she says, I will never forget the look on her face. And Andrea said, "I think you should have the whole gallery." And I was like, "What are you doing?"
You're an enabler.
Yeah, and she's like, "I think this is absolutely, absolutely worth, the whole gallery." And so, and Andrea really had to step out on faith with us because she didn't really know any of my visual work. She didn't know any of Angel's work, really. She only really knew me as a poet. And I said, "We're going to do a live performance, and I'm going to make 13 skulls. And, we're going to do an installation and a film." And Andrew was like, "That all sounds great. I'm going to give you a year." And somehow I learned how to cast resin skulls. somehow we got the funding from Kentucky Arts Council and the Kentucky Foundation for Women. Somehow we got 12 Kentucky musicians to agree to join us on stage for a live performance. And somehow we made a short film. I don't know how we pulled it off, guys. I really don't. But a year from then, in January 2013, we had a sold out, performance, standing room only, in Carrick Theater, and it was a singular experience. I don't think I've ever had anything like that since. I don't know if I ever will.
Yeah, was standing room only, even at the rehearsal. Before the actual performance, because I came that day because I was going to miss it, and I just came by myself, and it was remarkable. It was performance and experience that I will, really never forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here. Mm-hmm. I ended up going to the performance itself. Yeah. And it was just unbelievable. Is there anywhere that people can go to see that afterwards? Potentially, is it in the works?
I want it to be. It's one of those things where it really boils down to funding. Mm-hmm. And we have everything recorded. It's just trying to figure out how to package it and to partner with someone to maybe recreate it. Mm-hmm. But what's happened now is, of course, that show was 4 years ago, and so it sparked a lot of conversations about, what happens to Black women anyway. Mm. In politically infused situations. And so, that might be one of the things, Prince's archives that people find later. I don't know what's going to happen to it. I would like to make it accessible to people somehow one day. I've been trying to kind of rack my brain. But I think there might be a spinoff, performance I have in mind that really, builds on what that conversation started. So we'll see. You guys know I always have something up my sleeve.
Of course. Of course. That's why we love you.
Yeah.
So
we'll see.
So can we talk a little bit more about, because I know recently you've gotten into filmmaking, and I know particularly, with the projects we've discussed, but also your Live from the Mothership film that just came out. Can you talk to us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, so that was another Angel Clark collaboration, and with Kate. So what we wanted to do, every time I have a collection come out, I like to do at least, one short film as kind of like a trailer or promo. It's really interesting to me that poets really have not collaborated more in this region with filmmakers, because we have so many amazing shooters down here and producers, and poems are just ripe for like little short films, so hopefully people really, latch on to this idea. But we did Mothership last September, before my book release party for Galaxy, and I just wanted to kind of do a, like, it's like a Twilight Zone meets Mighty Morphin Power Rangers kind of feel. So that's what we did. And I love a shoot day because part of it is usually taking place in the Arboretum. I had a bunch of geeks come down in their cosplay, and it was fantastic. And they just marched down through the Arboretum in costume and pretended to get beamed up by a mothership. So it was really fun. That was a good day. That was a good shoot day. So yeah, that people can see that on my website.
You know, I came as Uhura from Star Trek to that that screening. I put Silas in that little Captain Spock outfit.
Cool. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. And so, you know, Bianca, I think with that, and I think as well with what women are made of, it seems like collaboration is a huge part of your artistic process. Do you think that it's a critical or important part of kind of your creation?
Yeah, so when I said earlier that art forms, you know, people are multilingual, you know, I don't make any sort of claim to be a professional filmmaker. I'm purely amateur only because, you know, it puts me in a place of learning something new about storytelling in general when I'm making a film or I'm thinking about it like a filmmaker might. So collaboration comes when you bring people on who see the world in similar and different ways. So it teaches you something new to work with them as well. When they say, hey, did you think about that angle? And it's like, no, I did not, you know?
Yeah.
So since I've been making films, one of the comments that I've gotten reviews most, and I don't think this is an accident, is that my work has become more filmic, you know, in terms of the scenes or setting the scene. And I think a lot of it has to do with thinking how many angles, you know, thinking in terms of frame and not necessarily, you know, strictly line. So yeah, collaboration is fun. It's crazy. We all hate each other, but we can't stop, you know, loving on one another.
Uh-huh.
It's just, there's nothing quite like it. It's like dating someone, you know, and it's either it's going to go really well or really badly.
Yeah.
So we're all going to find out, you know.
The symbiotic relationship. It's like a clownfish and an anemone, you know. You're going to it's going to burn you a little bit, but eventually you got a safe place to hang.
Right, not enough for you to actually leave.
Well, you know,
That's great.
Yeah, and Bianca, and I think about, you know, the Lexington Tattoo Project, which you wrote the poem for, called The Blank of the Universe, A Love Story. And that poem was tattooed on 253 people all around Lexington. So how does it feel to have your poem tattooed on 253 people? That's quite a collaboration.
Yeah.
I try not to think about it.
Are you like, maybe I should have changed that line? Oh, no.
Well, you know, I tell people I curated that poem.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kurt and Cremena approached me about it, they were like, would you write a love poem to Lexington? And I was like, love is a strong word, you know. I think at the time I was like, it has a strong word. It's complicated. If I was in a Facebook relationship with, you know, Lexington, we would say it's complicated. As any long-term relationship is, you know. So they said, well, can you try? And so I was out of ideas, you know. And so I just started asking people that I knew. I asked Facebook because Facebook is all-knowing and all-seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked other social media. I said, if you guys would say Lexington, you know, has a feel or is a blank of the universe, what would you put in there? And people came up with that. And then it took me back to, like, you know, being really young in Lexington and falling in love with someone and walking down, you know, the streets at night and just flirting or brunch the next day or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the narrative part came from. And a lot of the sights and experiences that people were talking about, I just sort of arranged into the poem. And so it's pretty cool to meet people. It's a living mural. It's like a living tapestry. And you know, it used to be after readings, people would come and shake your hand, and now they show me body parts.
That's funny.
It's pretty cool.
Can we, can you maybe also talk about the Gypsy Poetry Slam? I know it's now the Wild Women of Poetry, but
yeah.
I'm just curious of how that got started and if you're surprised by how much it's grown over the years.
Yeah, so actually it started off as a slam that Shayla Lawson and I, we did randomly at UK. It was called the Motto Slam. It was to, like, honor Langston Hughes' birthday or something strange like that. And somehow, in the time that I went to Milwaukee and come back, it had been absorbed into the, you know, the Women Writers Conference. And so nobody knew where the word came from or the term came from, Motto Slam. Nobody knew what that meant. And it was after a Langston Hughes poem. And so I said, I know where that is. I know what that came from, and we need to change the name. So we changed it to Gypsy Slam, and later we changed it to the Wild Women of Poetry Slam because we didn't want to offend anybody in terms of the ethnic term gypsy. Mm. But the term gypsy poet has been used for a traveling poet, performance artist, who goes around and just does their thing on stages all across the country. So that's where the concept came from. And that was back in, 2005, 2006 maybe? Mm-hmm. And so we just attached to the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, and I said, you know, why don't we give local women a chance to meet women who are doing this all over the country and have a feature poet? And it just sort of evolved from there and became this annual event that was something that everybody looked forward to in town. It was always over too soon. So, I don't think I expected it to grow as big as it did, but because there is a dearth of, slam in this area at the moment, I think it was most people's gateway into performance poetry, period. So we just wanted to make it an event.
You know, you've brought so many different projects and so many different incredible readings and programs to Lexington, and you have this presence on Facebook, and you have this voice in your collection of poetry. And as writers, we talk about, finding our voice and honing in on this voice. And I feel like you have so many, and I'm curious as to how, you develop, and there's all these conversations about platform as writers and developing your platform, and how your online voice and your poetry voice and your film voice, like, where do those intersect? How do those meet up? How do you balance them all?
I spend a lot of time alone, actually, because I gotta give the voices a lot of room to play. I actually do spend a lot of time alone, up to late at night, thinking really hard about things and pacing. But I really let I don't necessarily choose the vessel for the work. I let the work choose its own vessel. Mm-hmm. So some work is going to be more like a poem, which is what Claudia Rankine called a feeling space, and that's how I analyze things at an intuitive level. I'm most fluent in poetry. So if I'm trying to work through problems or trying to solve problems or interrogate ideas or issues, poetry is sort of my go-to. But there are some things that can't be confined to just, a poem. They have to be expanded, and so they're ongoing conversations, and they might turn into something more interactive, like a dialogue or a short story or an essay. But I think that the content with me is, again, it goes back to that hybridity and people and things and states of transition and transformation that's going to kind of, link everything together. I'm a geek, so there's going to be a lot of talk about science and things that I don't really know much about at a textbook level. But I kind of like to infuse in my work and show how human relationships mirror those of that of the cosmos and the natural world. You'll see a lot of that. And you'll see some, Star Trek or Doctor Who in there somewhere, and interest in aliens and that kind of thing. And as far as social media goes, building an audience. I curate that so people see, those aspects of my personality that are related most closely with my work. So that's why you'll see me post a lot about, sci-fi, Afro-speculative fiction, movies, things coming out that are interesting. A lot of cats. I like cat videos.
Don't we all?
A lot of shenanigans. on Facebook in particular. Crystals, whatever. Those are all sort of stem back to my literary or artistic interests. So that's how I do that.
So Bianca, if people want to learn more about your writing or your film or your visual art, where can people go to find out?
You can friend me on Facebook. You can follow along, because sometimes I disappear from Facebook.
We need those.
My website is just www.biancaspriggs.com. So they can follow along there.
Awesome. And Bianca, I know, we know it's bittersweet, but I know you're about to move to Athens, Ohio to teach at Ohio University. So
that's
right,
Chuck. Tell all my stalkers.
I know. Yeah. You're going to have to find another thing to do with your daytime. So I wanted to ask you, Bianca, what are some things that you think you'll miss about living in Lexington when you go teach at OU?
I think you know, I mean, it's obviously this is my home, and you know, I was talking to Kate, and I was like, Kate, am I? It just feels final this time, and I'm trying not to say that too loud because Lexington's listening.
So, you're killing us, Pete.
I think it's letting me go this time. I'm not sure, but I think we'll find out, right?
Yeah, they never really let you go, but
yeah, I just kind of miss. I'll miss and not miss this. Like whenever I go to like roll up the street to the Kroger, the gas station, like inevitably I run into somebody that I know, mm-hmm. you know, and just it feeling like home. Everything's familiar. I don't feel like I'm a stranger anywhere, any part of town, or really any part of the state. So going back to the first thing I said, I've never met a stranger here, you know, and just again, just having connections, being able to, you know, relate to people and be like, I think we're planning a Whole Foods field trip next week that just happens spontaneously on Facebook. And just knowing that I'm going to go into the new Whole Foods, the fancy new Whole Foods, and people are going to be there that I know. I just think that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
So, Lexington has taken really good care of me in that sense.
Yeah.
Out of trouble.
And it's such a great supportive community, and, you know, we'll miss you too as well. And, you know, you can always come back.
Yes.
It's so many.
Like 3.5 hours away. I think my dad did that with his mind because I'm still, like, the closest daughter to him, you know, so...
Yeah, and do you know about Ohio University's Halloween celebration that they have going on?
I have heard some things, and I've heard some people say, well, the city's trying to take it back. Like, it's, like, on par with, like, a New Orleans-type
I think it's the third largest block party in America. And actually, it's funny because the city of Athens itself is about 27,000. But when the Halloween comes in, it's like 15,000 to 30,000 people show up in Athens.
Whoa.
So sometimes more people show up than actually live in Athens, Ohio. So that's something fun to look forward to in October, I think.
Definitely. I mean, all the faculty have just said, just leave town. But I'm like, I can check this out first, man. Like,
yeah. You're like, have you heard my poem? Check out the mothership.
Right.
That's awesome. Right. So, Bianca, yeah. I wanted to ask you if you had something that you'd like to read for us, just to finish things up here.
Yeah, sure. I have this poem that I've been reading everywhere I go. It's called The Secret to Eternal Youth, and I read it everywhere I go now because I do believe that, politically speaking, there's a lot of fear being circulated and a lot of negativity and, you know, people sort of reinforcing one another's trauma, and to me the antidote to that is love. So this is my love poem that I'm going to dedicate to all of you. This is called The Secret to Eternal Youth. Fall in love, often, as often as possible. Stay with someone until you've heard all their stories, then fall in love again, with them or another. No matter, the heart is a muscle. It wants exercise. Each little tear can only make room for more. It does not matter who or how many or how often you love, just that you do. There is no time in love. What is an hour? What is a year? What is 100 years? Love does not know these names. Love is only constructed of love. How else might one see what they are capable of? How vast and how limitless a being, unless one's love is reckless and careless and given freely without fear. Love like a child. There is no shame in love, and there is no shape to it. It fills whatever vessel can hold it, an arc as easily as a thimble. The thing itself does not change. In love, there are no soulmates. There are no husbands, no wives, no children, no siblings, no friends. There is only love, and we are all on its path, companions. On this path, there is no such thing as who loves more than whom. One person's love is not more efficient than another's. There is no piety here, no conditions, no calculations to resolve. After all, what is the unit with which you would measure all of your tears, all of your sighs of pleasure or despair? How much does your sleeplessness weigh? And what of happiness? How tall is your contentment? How deep is your surrender? What is the circumference of how much love has changed you each and every time? So what happens when you find yourself at the bottom of love, where you think you have excavated every acre of your abandon. What else, you might say, is there possibly left to know or perceive that I have not already? That is where you must plant yourself, in that space of unknowing, and wait until you recognize in everyone that you have loved, in everything you have ever looked for in another, that the extended hand holding a hand, holding a hand, holding, is your own.
Mm. Thank you so much, Bianca.
Thank you, guys.
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Glad this worked out.
I'm tearing up over here.
It's all right, Jess. I'll close the show up. No, but for real, honestly, Bianca, you know we'll miss you. And for folks who are out there listening, we've been talking with Bianca Spriggs, local Appalachian poet, visual artist, filmmaker, celestial mermaid, so many other things. So we appreciate all the good work that you've done for our city and our state. And, you know, we'll miss you, but we know you'll send us a postcard.
Definitely.
Better.
Awesome.
I will.
Au revoir, Pee.
All right, guys.
All right. Well, thanks again, Bianca. It's been great talking with you, and thanks for spending some time to chat with us.
Okay, no problem. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Well, nonetheless, we'll be back here next week. Same time, same place, Friday from noon to 2 here on WLXU. I'm Chuck.
I'm Jess.
And we'll see you next week. Until then, we're going to play you out with a track that Bianca Spriggs is on, featuring Lexington's own Just Me. This is a track called Way of the Ronin off of Just Me's album. Hajime. We'll see y'all next week. Adios.
From the moment a Ronin decides he is his own master, he may seem to possess no more direction than the petal of a cherry blossom falling wherever it may in spring. But it is in this moment he becomes most free. After all, what do you fear more? The tiger chained to the stake in the backyard of the emperor's palace? Or the tiger that has escaped his bonds and now roams the land long enough to forget he was ever once owned, long enough to remember he was born wild? Most people believe it is in the throes of battle where great warriors are forged. But for the Ronin, this is not so. It is not one's commitment to his Daisho, but the opposite, a willingness to abandon all, even his own swords, should they not aid his cause, be that simple curiosity or the exquisite art of vengeance. For the way of the Ronin is uncertain. One path is as good as another for the wanderer, who is as anchorless as the waves in the sea. Above all, he must be content to never know his fate, and yet believe that each direction he takes leads him further down the road of destiny.